as I wait. Heart of God.
Hello, my friend. Welcome to the Growth Group Podcast, where we believe that growth happens in groups which read the Bible together and ask questions together. This week, we're looking at Psalm 23, and unfortunately, Jonathan is not going to join me for this podcast, as he is on a mini spiritual retreat where he's getting himself ready for the next big series our church is going to be starting this fall, called Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, which is a great series based upon a book by a man named Peter Scazzaro. We're gonna ask and answer some really deep and important questions for each of our walks. Looking forward to that. But this week we are in Psalm 23, a wonderful, wonderful psalm, which I'm gonna read for you first, and then we're gonna go through our four questions on that psalm. So here is Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely, goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Isn't that wonderful? That is so beautiful. Well, our four questions for this psalm, as usual, we're starting with a question called close reading, in which we ask you to, do just that. Closely read this text, these six verses, and pay attention to what the Lord is speaking to you as you read these verses. Look for things that jump out from the page to you, questions you might have. What's this about anointing my head with oil? What does that mean? And maybe personal applications as well, where the Lord feels like the Lord's directing you to do something or to think in a different way. So that's our close reading question. Our next set of questions, 2, 3, and 4, look at this psalm in different pockets of verses. So the next question, question 2, looks at the first 3 verses, and then question 3 looks at verse 4, and then our last question looks at verse 5 and 6. So question 2 then, focusing on verses 1, 2, and 3. The question is called The Good Shepherd, and here's the question. How were Jesus' words, I am the Good Shepherd, both a claim to deity and the throne in Jerusalem? Look at the action words in Psalm 23, verses 2 and 3. How has Jesus restored your soul in past months? In what parts of your life might you pray for your shepherd to lead you to green pastures and beside still waters? So let's back up to the first part of this question. Jesus' words in John 10, I am the good shepherd. That's an important passage for us when we think about anything related to shepherding in the Bible. Here's a few verses from that chapter. I am the good shepherd, John 14 and 15. I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. Jesus says in John 10, 14, and 15. And then down in 27, it says, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. So in the book of John, Jesus makes 10 I am statements. This is one of them. I am the good shepherd. In the same chapter, he says, I am the door for the sheep. And then others, like, I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the vine. But when Jesus is making any of these statements, these I am statements, they are a claim to deity, certainly, because they use that phrase I am, ego eimi in the Greek, but they're a reference to God's self-declaration to Moses at the burning bush back in Exodus 3. We studied Exodus, as, or at least the first handful of chapters of Exodus, the first half, together as a church last year. And we took a look at that. I think it was actually me who preached that passage of God's self-revelation in Exodus chapter 3, where Moses asks, "What shall I say is the name of the Lord if I am to go back to my people and tell him that the Lord has appeared to me?" And God said to Moses, "I am who I am. Say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you." Which is the grammatical kind of background behind God's personal covenant name, Yahweh, I am. So, when Jesus says, "I am the resurrection and the life," he's making a subtle claim to deity. But we can go farther than that. The reference to Jesus as a shepherd is also, to an extent, a reference to his deity as well. For God, in the Old Testament, claimed to be the shepherd of his people. This is clear in our psalm. It opens, "The Lord," that is God, "the Lord," Yahweh is a phrase in Hebrew. It's not Adonai. "The Lord is my shepherd." But this concept of God as a shepherd began in the first book of the Bible, Genesis 48:15. We record, it says that Jacob blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day." Jacob references God as his shepherd. Psalm 28, verse 9. "O save your people and bless your heritage. Be the shepherd and carry them forever." Psalm 80, verse 1. "Give ear, O shepherd of Israel, you who lead Joseph like a flock, you who are enthroned above the cherubim." And this links to our next concept as well, as a shepherd being a link to kingship as well. And then finally, "For he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, and the sheep of his hand." That's in Psalm 95, verse 7. So when Jesus says that he's a good shepherd, he's saying slightly, "I'm also God, I'll have you know." And then this question as well, it asks, how are Jesus' words, "I'm the good shepherd," both a claim to deity, which we just looked at, and also a claim to the throne in Jerusalem, by which I mean a claim to be the king of Israel. So you'll, of course, know where I'm going with this. In the Old Testament, kings were often described with a metaphor of a shepherd. So look at these words by the people of Israel when they want to anoint David as their king for a second time after the death of Saul. And they say to David in 2 Samuel 5:2, "In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you, David, who led us out into battle. And the Lord said to you, 'You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel.'" So here clearly shepherd is related to kingship. One more verse connecting shepherding to kingship. In Psalm 78, verses 70 and 71, it says, "God chose David as his servant and took him from the sheepholds. From following the nursing ewes, he brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, Israel, his inheritance." So, the Lord chose a shepherd of sheep to become a shepherd of his nation, Israel. And Jesus would make a claim to kingship as well. We studied the passage of Jesus' triumphal entry not long ago, which relates to his entering Jerusalem as a supposed king. And then my favorite verse when it comes to Jesus' kingship, at least in the book of Matthew, it is Matthew 25:31, where it says that when the Son of Man, that is Jesus, comes in his glory at his second coming, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Looking forward to that day. So the second part of this question to addresses action words. It says, look at the action words of Psalm 23 and ask, how has the Lord, how has your shepherd acted in those ways towards you, and how might you ask him to act in those ways? So let me just look at those action words quickly, and then we'll move on to our next question. First, it says, he makes me lie down in green pastures. That's an action word. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness. All beautiful actions that our shepherd does towards us. But our next question, question three, the valley, focusing on verse 4 from Psalm 23, the valley. While the shepherd's ultimate purpose is to lead you to green pastures and beside still waters, it is sometimes necessary to take you through the valley of the shadow of death. Why is this? Has he taken you through these valleys? Were you able to say, like David, I will fear no evil? What is your only comfort in these dark places? So our first little question or sub-question here in question number 3 asks, why is it necessary for the Lord to take us through valleys of darkness, of the shadow of death? If he is the good shepherd, shouldn't he be able to lead us beside still waters into green pastures all the time? Why do we have to go through these dark places? Well, this is kind of hints at what has been called the problem of evil or the problem of suffering. If God is a good God, why is there evil in this world? And my default, or what is becoming my default answer for that question in recent days, is just the response that, yeah, the Lord isn't happy about all the evil he sees in this world either. As a matter of fact, the world is in rebellion against him, and that's why we see suffering. It's not because God is inflicting it upon poor innocent bystanders, but the world itself is in rebellion against God. And when I say the world, I'm referring both to people and to the planet itself. Romans 8 says that the creation, this is Romans 8, 19 through 22, says that the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself would be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. So the creation, the tsunamis that we see and earthquakes and all that stuff, it seems that those things occur, at least in part because this creation is in bondage to corruption, and it is groaning, as in the pains of childbirth, up to this present moment. So if God were to remove the suffering and remove the evil from this world, he would need to remove us, because we are the source of that evil. Instead, God is going about a much more difficult task than simply removing all the little sources of evil, which is like weeding or something in a garden. He's reconciling this evil world to himself. In Colossians 1:20, it says that through Jesus, he's going to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on heaven and in earth. And the Gospels have proven to us that in order to reconcile all things back to God, that's a process that's going to require suffering. It's going to require a cross. And if it's okay for Christ to go to the cross in order for this work of reconciliation to go forward, certainly it must be okay for us to endure our own quantities of suffering as well. Now, this isn't a suffering that we must just simply grit our teeth and endure, but the Lord has promised comfort and strength to us in our suffering. And what is that comfort? This question three asks. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. It's his very presence in the darkness. For you are with me. I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Which makes me think of Matthew 28 and our Great Commission, where it says, I will be with you always, even unto the end of the age. Next question, last question, question 4. God's preparation. Isn't that interesting? God is preparing. God's preparation, dealing with the last two verses of Psalm 23. Just as Jesus is preparing a place for us in my Father's house, where we will dwell in the house of the Lord forever, so also our good shepherd is preparing a table in the presence of our enemies. How does this future hope of dwelling with God forever and being vindicated before our enemies give us assurance of God's present care for us, his goodness and mercy, even when we don't see them? So yeah, just the way that this question's phrased, I admit, it's a little bit complicated, and I'm sorry for that. So we have a couple elements going here. God, and Jesus specifically, he's preparing two things. He's preparing a place for us in his Father's household, and that's taken from John 14. The first three verses read this way: "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God and believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you to myself, that where I am you may be also." So he's preparing a place for us. He's preparing a room in his Father's house. But that's not the only thing that he's preparing. In Psalm 23, it says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies." Now, what is going on there? Well, I've read a number of commentaries, and Jonathan has too, and I'm not sure just where he's going to take this. And if he was here with me recording this podcast, perhaps he can correct some of what I've learned about this verse. But some people out there in the scholarly world think it might refer to a victory celebration, perhaps even the marriage supper of the Lamb. Here in verses 5 and 6, we have a shift of metaphor from God as shepherd in verses 1 through 4 to now God as host, hosting a banquet of sorts in verses 5 and 6. So we have here God preparing a victory celebration for his righteous people in the presence of his enemies. Now what does that mean? It seems possibly that these enemies might be unwilling spectators at this banquet, allowed to see the pleasure and delight and reward given to the righteous in the form, perhaps symbolically, of this banquet feast, but certainly not permitted to enjoy that feast alongside the righteous. So they are in the presence of those feasting, but certainly kept outside of this privileged position. Now, I think that this has some legitimacy to it because, it makes me think of a quote that I, that's really been kind of transformative for me, which I heard back when I was in college reading through a devotional by D.A. Carson, a really brilliant scholar. It was a devotional that goes through a reading plan, reading through the Bible in a year. And it was focusing on the last chapter of Job, which is where, after everything has been taken from Job, here in the last chapter, chapter 42, it's all given back to him. And Carson reflects on this chapter, saying that not only must justice be done in this world, not only must justice be done, but it must be seen to be done. It must be put on visible display before all, that is, before the righteous and before the unrighteous, before earthly spectators and before heavenly spectators. So the unrighteous must know that the Lord will bless his righteous people. It's part of a public display of his justice. And I think that we kind of hit on this concept a little bit in our First Peter series a number of weeks ago in chapter 2, where it says, "Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they say you're evil. When they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." So even though in this life they're going to speak against you as evildoers, when God comes again, when Jesus returns on the day of visitation, they will finally see your good deeds and glorify God, though it seems that they'll be headed in a different direction. Yeah, justice must be done and must be seen to be done. Well, thank you so much for enduring this slightly longer podcast episode. I hope you've taken away a couple of nuggets and for your study of Psalm 23, and I hope that it's a blessing to you and to your growth groups. God bless.
As I wait, heart of God, satisfy and sustain.